Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Ivor Davis, the author of the new book Manson Exposed, a reporter's 50-year journey into madness and murder. Ivor is a Londoner by birth. He came to the United States in the 1960s, and he was working as the West Coast correspondent for the London Daily Express. And it was a newspaper. His reporting took him to the front lines of all kinds of things in history, traveling with the Beatles during the band's first American tour in 64. He was there at the Ambassador Hotel with Senator Robert Kennedy during the assassination. But 50 years ago this summer, in fact this month, Ivor found himself covering what would become known as the Tate-LaBianca murders and the trial of Charles Manson and the members of his family. Ivor, August 9th of 1969, you started covering these Tate murders before anyone knew they were the Tate murders, right?
Yes, I did. I mean, as a reporter, I went straight out to Cielo Drive because I'd been told by the wire services in my London office that there'd been a mass murder. They didn't know who. They didn't know who was involved. But, you know, this is what we did. We went straight to the scene. I went to the scene on that Saturday morning, and I recall it very vividly. And there was panic and confusion. And then the horrible story unfolded before our very eyes, almost.
So I assume that you were able to get up to maybe the gate, or could you even get that close?
Yes, we were at the front gate, because by the time I arrived, the cops had sort of sealed off the front gate, and so we stood outside the front gate and saw this frantic activity going inside. And in fact, believe it or not, they hadn't even removed the bodies when I got there. And, you know, we were all clamoring for information, but the cops were very tight-lipped because, frankly, they didn't know in the early hours what it was of the investigation, what it was all about. And we stayed there for the whole day.
So were you able to see Stephen Parent's vehicle? Because he was close to the gate, right?
Yes, I was. I mean, I remember because there was this car sitting kind of in a strange angle. I mean, it wasn't pointed out. Because what we discovered had happened was young Stephen Parent, who, as you know, was in the wrong place at the wrong time, was leaving because he visited a friend in the guest house on the Cielo Drive house. And Mr. Charles Tex Watson came along, saw him, he saw Watson, and Watson shot him about four times in the car. And that was the first of the killings.
Well, it took several months for law enforcement to piece it all together, not only that the Tate and LaBianca murders the next night were connected, but that Charles Manson and his family were the culprits. So how did the press keep the story alive, or did it, during that time in a city in Los Angeles where there's so much else going on?
Well, excuse me. Well, what happened was everybody was totally, utterly baffled. Nobody knew what it was all about. And we every day and then every week, we would call the cops and say, what's going on? And they said, there's nothing more. We've checked this out. We're questioning people. And then the astonishing fact was that how the case was finally solved was this. Susan Atkins was one of the killers that went with Charles Tex Watson to the Sharon Tate house. She was in jail, but not accused of the murder of Sharon Tate, accused of the murder of a musician named Gary Hinman, who'd been brutally tortured and murdered 10 days before the Sharon Tate murders. She was in jail for that. She started boasting to her cellmates. She said, do you know what happened to Sharon Tate? And they listened, and she spun them an amazingly detailed story of the murders. At first, they thought she was boasting, but when she gave them such meticulous details, they were terrified, and they went to police authorities in the jail, and eventually the homicide detectives came to interview Susan Atkins, and Susan Atkins spilled her guts.
So, but for Susan Atkins, we may never have known this, because there wasn't a lot of physical evidence, or any physical evidence, that connected the Manson family, right?
Not really. I mean, the cops did find a fingerprint that they were able to identify with Charles Tex Watson, but all they had were bloody bodies, blood-drenched bodies, and all these kind of weird messages on the walls, painted in, daubed in the blood of the victims that said Helter Skelter and pig and stuff like that. But they did not know in any way that not only that the Sharon Tate murders were in any way linked to Lino and LaBianca, who were murdered 24 hours later, 15 miles away from the Sharon Tate house.
So the story about how Charles Manson's arrested, you detail it well in the book, basically for car theft, and then everything gets connected. But after Manson is arraigned up in Inyo County, you made your way to the Spahn Ranch, where the family hung out. Tell me about what you were hoping to learn.
Well, as soon as we heard about Charles Manson being the mastermind of this kind of hippie cult family, I rushed down to the Spahn Ranch, which I should tell you is a, I mean, it was a rundown flea pit of a ranch. I mean, it stank of horse manure and flies, and yet still living there were a bunch of family members. And I was fortunate enough to talk to three family members, Brooks Poston, Paul Watkins, and Danny DiCarlo, who were not involved in the murders, and they spun me a story of life with Manson, the way he lived it, the way he brainwashed everybody, the way he handed out candy, which was actually drugs, and how, and this was what I had difficulty believing, how he played the Beatles' White Album and songs like Helter Skelter and Piggies and Revolution, and he made them believe, they did believe, that the Beatles were predicting a race war, but Charlie, being the shrewd brain he was going to dodge the race war by getting into his dune buggy and hiding out in Death Valley in an underground city. I mean, as Brian, as we talk about it, when I tell you this story, you've got to say, Ivor, you are crazy.
Ivor, you're crazy.
Thank you.
when you talk to them, though, did you get the sense that the women, especially the women with Manson, were rebellious teenagers, or were they something else, just vulnerable?
Well, I mean, Charlie Manson was a very shrewd guy. I mean, he was a manipulator. He learned to survive as a small guy in prisons and in jails all his life. As a young man, he was in prison, he was in jail, reform school, where he was beaten up. So he realized his lip, his mouth, his tongue could be his passport to survival in behind bars. And he used that technique he learned in jail to manipulate these very, very malleable young women. I mean, most of them came from well-to-do homes. One was a trust fund kid. And they were looking for a father. And Charlie was their father, their lover, their dictator, their boss, who ruled with an iron rod with a equal doses of love and equal doses of cruelty.
I'm chatting with Ivor Davis about his brand new book, Manson Exposed, the reporter's 50-year journey into madness and murder. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold. We all know the Helter Skelter book. Vincent Bugliosi, the prosecutor who won the convictions of the Manson and his family members. The story that he wove, not only at the trial but in the book as well, is that the murders, the Sharon Tate and LaBianca murders, were based upon lyrics of the Beatles. And that narrative has stuck now for 50 years. You have an insight into this. You knew the Beatles. You know this Manson story. Was this a Beatles motive murder?
Of course not. I mean, if any of your listeners play Helter Skelter or Piggies, I mean, none of those lyrics, and the Beatles told me this themselves, they were disgusted that this should be used in the way it was used. I mean, listen to the lyrics. There's nothing about murder, black-white race wars, and yet Manson made them believe it. And yet, and this is the remarkable thing, Vincent Bugliosi, who was a hard-driving, obsessed deputy district attorney, used it to convict Manson. And I was at the trial for nearly a year, and when I heard it, I heard the motive. I thought, he's had it. No way they're going to convict. But they did convict. And part of the reason they convicted, Brian, was this, that Manson behaved like a lunatic in front of the jury. And believe it or not, and it's hard to imagine, Manson and the other defendants, Susan Atkins, Leslie Van Houten, Patricia Krenwinkel, never testified in their own defense. So it's kind of a crackpot trial. The jury saw Charlie manipulating the girls in court, and they found him guilty, even though the motive, in my opinion, was a bit crackpot.
Well, you mentioned the murder of Gary Hinman, and Bobby Beausoleil had been arrested for that murder. So how does that take us to the motive for Tate LaBianca murders?
Okay, let me just give you a very fast timeline, Brian. July 27, 1969, Gary Hinman, who was a musician, a teacher, a fairly peaceable guy, who made a bit of money on the side cooking up mescaline and selling it to his friends, was confronted by Manson and Bobby Beausoleil. Beausoleil was a right-hand man and friend of Manson and a musician. And they said, give me your money, Gary. And Gary said, I don't have any money. They didn't believe him, and they started torturing him. And Charlie Manson cut Hinman's ear off with a Japanese sword. And then Susan Atkins, who was there, sewed it on again with the dental floss. Then Charlie left the scene and said, get the money from Gary. Gary called him at the Spam Ranch and said, Bobby Beausoleil called Charlie at the Spam Ranch and said, he's not saying anything. He's not giving us anything. And Charlie said, finish him off. Bobby Beausoleil ran out of the murder house, took the murder victim's car, was arrested sleeping in the car by a highway patrolman who checked the car and discovered it was belonging to the victim, Gary Hinman. Fast forward, Manson was upset that he, because it was his order to kill Hinman, that Beausoleil was in prison. So Manson, and I know this sounds pretty wild and way out, Manson decided to set up the Sharon Tate murders and the LaBianca murders, put the same modus operandi signs, like blood daubed on the wall, messages on the wall. Manson, in his warped mind, thought that if the cops saw those two murders, which were similar to the Gary Hinman murder, they would say, hey, Bobby Beausoleil is innocent, let's let him out. But of course, it never happened. And Beausoleil is still in jail today.
You were covering the Manson trial, especially the first one. Do you have a reserved seat in the courtroom? And what did the courtroom look like as far as people wanting to come in and see this spectacle?
It was a packed courtroom. Fortunately, there were 24 of us journalists who covered it every day. We all had our same seats in the second row, sitting behind Manson and the girls and the bevy of lawyers. But it was like a hot ticket, a Broadway show. I mean, people who wanted to get in were there at 5 in the morning, lining up. And of course, there were limited numbers of seats. A lot of celebrities showed up because it was a hot ticket trial, and it was theater. It was theater of the absurd, because every day and you know you have legal experience. Every day, I mean, a trial is supposed to be carried out with decorum, a certain decorum. This never happened. Every day, Manson performed. The girls performed, mimicking him. He shaved his head. He carved a swastika in his forehead. He shouted at the judge. He tried to stab the judge with a sharp pencil, and the bailiff rugby tackled him. So we went along every day, and nothing. It was never a normal day, believe me. And it was the hot the show in town in Hollywood.
Well, you mentioned the lawyers, and there were a whole bunch of them throughout this, but the one I thought was most interesting was Ron Hughes, the hippie lawyer, defense attorney for Leslie Van Houten. Even before he went missing, I thought it was so interesting. The guy was basically broke, right?
He was broke. He lived in the garage of a friend's house. He didn't have a telephone. The only piece of furniture was his California Bar Association certificate hanging on the wall. He was a sweet guy. A very nice guy, but he had zilch experience. I mean, he'd never handled a traffic ticket. And yet, here he was, starting off, believe it or not, representing Manson. And then Manson got Irving Kinnerick, another guy, and maybe we'll talk about him. And Ron Hughes then took over the defense of Leslie Van Houten. But three-quarters of the way into the trial, Mr. Hughes disappeared. And 4 months later, his body was found in a ditch about 200 miles from the courtroom. And people said somebody murdered him. And people said, no, it was natural causes. So, you know, you take your pick.
Well, and it even got to the point where you were giving him rides and even a jacket to wear at one point, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the ridiculousness of it. I mean, Ron Hughes, as I say, was an amiable guy. And after court every day, he would go out with me and the other members of the media, and we would buy him drinks, and he would be friendly. He'd be like a pal. But he didn't have any money. And the funny thing is that on one occasion, the judge cited him for contempt and said, Mr. Hughes, do you want to pay the $75 fine? Otherwise, you're going to spend a night in jail. And Ron said, I'll take the night in jail because I get free breakfast in the morning. And That was the kind of guy he was. And we even had a little whip round for to give him some money so he could buy a jacket. He was a big guy, about 44, 46 inches chest, heavy set guy, 225 pounds, and he needed a big jacket. So, I mean, it was the kind of stuff that you couldn't dream up, but it happened.
Well, and Irving Kinnaric, Manson's lawyer, he was another character, right?
Oh, I mean, Irving Kinnaric was the one, when judges heard that Irving Kinnaric was going to be in front of them, they shuddered. Now, they didn't shudder for fear. They shuddered because he was a numero uno obstructionist. I mean, he could argue a piffling thing for a day. I tell you what happened. At the closing argument of the trial, Mr. Kinnaric spoke for 7 days. And after 3 days, the jurors asked the bailiff if they could get no-dose pills. Irving went on and on. He was rapped on the knuckles by the judge dozens of times. Several times he spent a couple of nights in jail for contempt. I don't know. I mean, a lot of people think that Irving's secret was he wore the jury down. He certainly wore the jury down in this case.
The press seemed to get along fairly well, the different journalists that were there. You've got a photograph in the book, and then you talk about it. There was a press party called the Come Dressed as Your Favorite Manson Family Member at the downtown L.A. Hilton. How did that type of party come about? Because I can't imagine that anybody would do that these days.
Well, you know, they wouldn't do it today, but you've got to realize that we went through nearly a year of unrelenting awfulness. And in a way, this is kind of, I guess, dark humor, because we had to have some relief. And so I think from the unrelenting testimony, the victims, the autopsies, the terrible stuff that we listened to, the press corps who had to be exposed to it, said, let's have a party. I mean, talking about it right now, Brian, it's in terrible, terrible bad taste. Because on the wall of that party which I went to, there was a sign saying, I'm the devil, here to do the devil's work, which, of course, was one of the lines that Charles Tex Watson delivered to Abigail Folger when she said, who are you? Why are you here on the night of the murders? So I guess it's just black humor. Looking back at it, it was with the distance of time, as we are doing, it sounds like the ultimate in bad taste, but we didn't feel like it at that time.
Bugliosi, all these years later, I know he died a few years back, but did he ever come to accept the fact that this whole Beatles connection was just bogus?
No, of course not, because don't forget, I mean, here's the thing. Here is a lawyer who made his international reputation with Helter Skelter, and when anybody ever questioned the reason, the raison d'etre that he used it, Vince would get very upset. I mean, I know a writer went to him and said, hey, this doesn't make sense, that doesn't make sense, and Vince got very angry, because after all, what you're doing is you are destroying the roots of a legendary legal career, and Vince knew that if people did that, then they would see that maybe, you know, he was a man made of paper. But I will say this, that Vince put blood, sweat, and tears into this case, and whatever method he used, he was successful. But I think the jury would have convicted Manson, seeing the way he behaved anyway. But there it is. So Vince did an amazing job, but it was all built on, I don't know, on mystery and magic and smoke and all that stuff.
Was there any point during your coverage of this that you felt that it was just too much? I mean, just too over the top to even continue, or did you have the support of your paper throughout this whole thing?
Well, the paper was fascinated. I mean, England has always been fascinated by the peculiarities of America. I mean, and I used to write a column every day for my London paper. The paper had 4.5 million readers every day, and it was called This Is America. But strangely enough, I told the editor, you know, this should be called This Is Not America, because it was mostly morsels of information about odd stories, because America was the hotbed of odd stories, and the Manson trial was the king and queen of this. of odd stories.
As you look back on your time, do you partake? I mean, I know you still live in the Los Angeles area, California. Do you partake in any of the Manson stuff? Read the books that come out, see the museums, take the tours, any of that stuff, or are your own memories sufficient for this?
Well, I mean, I don't bother with the tours, but whenever a new book comes out, I'm always keen to read it to see what fresh take is on it. You know, people history. You read the story and you find revisionist stuff. I mean, I read the books by Charles Tex Watson and even Manson in his own words, and you discover that they are revisionist, and they're written with, you know, self-interest in mind. So I do like to look at the books. I went to see, for example, I couldn't wait to see Quentin Tarantino's movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I loved the movie. I had some reservations, and I don't want to spoil it for your listeners. Have you seen the film, Brian?
No, but I read the New York Times, so thanks to them, I know how it ends.
Okay, well, that's the point, really, and you don't want to spoil a person's ending. But all I'm going to say on that film, and I say I'm not spoiling it for you, is remember this, Brian. It's called Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It is a fairy story. It is a Grimm's fairy story. It has great performances, and it recreates 1969 to perfection. Believe me, I was there. And it's sort of a fun movie, I know. It sounds silly. It's worth seeing, but don't take it that seriously.
All right. Well, we do take your book seriously because it was fantastic. The book is Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder by Ivor Davis. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold. You can also get onto his website and read his blog. Ivor, it's always fantastic to read anything you write because you've just been on the front porch of history in the West Coast for so long. So thanks for joining us today to share some of these memories.
Thank you for your kind words and your time, Brian.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.